All right, Clanton. You called down the thunder. Well, now you got it. So run, you curse.
Run! Tell all the other curs the lie's coming. You tell them I'm coming. And hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Down off your pale horses, Junkions, because you have just wandered into this OK Corral here at Junk Food Cinema, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast so good it just has to be fattening. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, joined as per usual by my friend and co-host. He's a screenwriter, he's a novelist, he's a lieutenant of Megaforce, he's my Huckleberry, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hey. Wow, I'm really kind of excited about this episode.
Kind of?
Well, look, okay.
How it is a travesty that it took us this long to do this movie.
It is and it isn't. There's a reason why it took this long to do this movie. I have spent the last 23 years hating this movie.
Ooh.
And I knew that I owed it a rewatch, and I've been putting off rewatching it, and then it was just the perfect timing. Like, this episode is the perfect bridge. We get to have a little kind of last little wisps of Mr. Doctor going on while we move into our random movie month. And it was just one of those movies that I was like, you know what? It's time. It's time that I address my issues with this movie. And I sit down and watch it again.
I love this. This is a great narrative for this episode. And if you, when Cargill mentioned Mr. Doctor, if you want to know what he's talking about, go back on iTunes and Stitcher and listen to our last four episodes of Mr. Doctor, the series where we talked about some of our favorite cinematic Doctor characters. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. And if you really like the show, if you're just head over heels, if you find out that this show is in fact your Huckleberry, you can become a patron by going to patreon.com/Junk Food Cinema. Any amount that you give us per episode is greatly appreciated. And in fact, tonight I recorded the very first taste test episode, which is an even further bonus exclusive for our patrons. We still do our weekly content just for patrons, but this is an extra show on top of that. This is the horseradish on top of the triple stack Arby's roast beef sandwich just for the patrons. So if you would like to hear what that sounds like, if you want to submit movies...
It's not the sprinkles on top of your sundae?
It's the sprinkles on the sundae. It's the cherry on top of your Arby's roast beef sandwich. I eat roast beef sandwiches a lot.
You like to put a lot of weird things on roast beef sandwiches.
I put a lot of interesting condiments on them.
I live a block away from an Arby's, and
you
I
are the only
the
way.
Time
you are the only reason I get to eat Arby's because you live so close to one, and I do not. So every time I drive up here, it's like potato cakes. What were we talking about? Sorry.
We were talking about Patreon.
Yes. So become a patron. Listen to the very first episode of the Taste Test. A patron by the name of Meryl Barr submitted a movie called Space is the Place. One of the weirdest fucking things I've ever seen in my life. And that review is basically me sitting weepy in a Chick-fil-A parking lot trying to explain what happened to me.
Which is what we call Wednesday.
Speaking of Wednesday, this episode is, as Cargill said, ushering us out of Mr. Doctor and into a month of randomly curated episodes for December, and we're starting with one of my favorite movies of all time. I'm going to call it right now. And the second George P. Cosmatos movie we have covered on this show.
Here's the interesting thing about this movie. If ever there was...
Oh, I guess we should say, before we get too far in, we're talking about Tombstone.
They say every town has a story. Tombstone as a legend.
Who is he?
That's Wyatt Earp. Made a name for himself as a peace officer.
I heard of you.
I'm retired.
You must be Doc Holliday. Are you retired too?
Not me. I'm in my prime.
The first time in our lives we got a chance to stop wandering and finally be a family. Now this is trouble we don't need.
If we're gonna have a future in this town, it's gotta have some law and order.
Now the time has come for justice.
Guess maybe you better swear me in.
And he has to live up to his reputation.
You got a fight coming.
I'll be there!
One last time.
None of your problem, Doc. You don't have to mix up in this.
That is a hell of a thing for you to say to me.
Justice is coming to Tombstone.
This is the junk food cinema super movie. Like, if you were to put together so many of the elements of what we've talked about in films this year and over the course of the entire series, this movie would kind of bring it all together. As you said, directed by George P. Cosmatos, who also did such films as Cobra. And Rambo 2. Rambo First Blood Part 2. And
which, by the way, we've mentioned this before. One of the most awkwardly titled franchises of all time.
Yes. Yes. And so he's you know, a junk food master.
And Leviathan, which I'm sure we'll cover at some point.
Oh, God. Yeah, we've got... You know what? The fact that we haven't done a Leviathan Deep Star 6 double feature episode astounds me, because I can only watch those movies together. In fact, my wife had not seen either of them in one night. It was an apocalyptically rainy night. And I'm like, tonight's the night. We're watching Deep Star 6 and Leviathan, and watch it with water pouring out our windows off the roof. And it was just fucking amazing.
And also, we haven't gotten to say this in a while. Take a drink, junkies. Future episode on the horizon.
But the thing about Tombstone is that you guys know that I'm a huge Magnificent Seven fan. I've talked about Unforgiven. Another movie, take another drink, because another movie we haven't covered that we need to cover eventually, Quick and the Dead.
Oh my God, yes.
All of these are amazing Westerns with some of the best casts of all time. And I have to say some, because this is the Western with the single greatest, biggest genre cast of all time.
Can I, before you go any further, can I just point out that as we're sitting here recording this, in one of the greatest Oscar and Felix moments of our entire podcasting career, I'm sitting here in my work clothes, my button-down shirt, my dress pants. You are sitting there in your pajamas, and the only reason I'm bringing this up is because I just noticed your shirt says "Space Cowboy Died for You."
Oh yeah, this is my homemade
Battle Beyond the Stars shirt. Okay, continue, sir.
Which I get to see tomorrow night with Sybil Danning.
Shut the fuck up!
It's playing here in town, motherfucker.
I tried to get Sybil Danning on this show because of that. Failure. We'll try again next week.
I'm really excited about Battle Beyond the Stars.
That's amazing.
There is no cast in a Western better or bigger than this cast. This cast is so fucking big.
How big is it?
It's so big that even the small walk-on characters are fucking huge.
Are played by Billy goddamn Zane.
Oh, you Billy Zane. How about some random guy who gets his ass whooped in the street played by Billy Bob Thornton? How about a random rancher who takes them in towards the end of the movie played by Charlton fucking Heston? How about the narrator being Robert fucking Mitchell?
Oh my God,
talking about, like, these are not actors that you just name them. These are actors you have to put the word fucking in the middle of their name because it's all of their middle names.
Yeah.
Oh. I mean, those are just the small character. Also in that group, Jason Priestley, just some small throwaway character. I say throwaway, but not really. But, you know, it just, these smaller roles are entirely, even the gangs. Like, okay, so we'll just start, like, of course the Earps. Of course you'd expect the Earps to be great, but we're talking legendary.
Holy goddamn shit. Like, this movie, first of all, is one of the most manly things you can ever consume with your eyeballs.
Yes.
It is like machismo syrup on top of a stack of pancakes.
It is to Westerns what the Expendables wanted to be.
Yes! Yes, it so is. I'm so glad you said that.
This is what this movie is. So, of course, we've got the Earps. And the Earps are played by Kurt Russell.
Yep.
Sam Elliott.
Yep.
Bill Paxton.
Better fucking believe it.
And then, of course, we have the namesake for our Mr. Doctor, Doc Holliday himself, Val Kilmer.
Okay.
But wait.
Yes.
They're not the coolest group of people in this fucking movie.
But wait, there's more.
Because we have the Cowboys.
Oh.
And oh my God, the Cowboys are played by Junk Food Alumni Extraordinaire. So they're led by Powers Booth.
You gotta love Powers Booth.
Powers Booth's number one man, Johnny Ringo, is played by Michael Biehn.
Come on!
And yeah, and because that's not enough, because we also have Thomas Hayden Church.
Oh, and we're not even close to done. Even
close to Stephen fucking Lang for the third time this year.
Oh, my
Stephen
God.
Lang playing Ike Clampett.
I'm not an expert on the Chinese zodiac, but I'm pretty sure 2016 is the year of the Stephen Lang.
It's, oh God, it's
at least on this show, it's the year of the Lang.
It's the year of the Lang, and it's the year that I think a lot of people realized how awesome Stephen Lang is and just started going back and revisiting movies and going, holy shit, Stephen Lang is in this movie, and realizing that they've seen Stephen Lang for years, and it wasn't until this year with Don't Breathe that they went, this guy's awesome, and then looked back and said, holy shit, that's, but you know what? We just said Stephen Lang, so you know what, you know what it means it's time for? One of the only impressions I can do.
Do it.
This is Pandora.
I use Spotify, but yeah. The planet. Yeah, no, I got it. You know what's funny?
Your eyes for jujubes.
What's jujubes? The official junk food parody. I'm jumping ahead. What I love about this movie is that even after I started really getting into Stephen Lang as an actor, and as much as I watch this movie, this is a movie I watch at least four times a year. I still didn't recognize Stephen Lang in this movie.
Because he's actually giving as many great performances are in this movie, Stephen Lang is out acting the shit out of everyone.
Because he's the only one in this movie performing against his own type.
Yes. Yeah, no, he is an incredibly alpha male driven actor playing that down in a big way and playing a beaten up bullying beta male. He is acting circles around everybody. Like, everybody's great. Like, nobody is weak in this movie. There are no weak performances. There is nobody that just phones it in. Everybody's great, but Stephen Lang is fucking going above and beyond in this movie.
Law don't go around
just
here.
Just fucking stealing every goddamn scene he's in. It's fucking great how good he is in this movie.
One of my favorite moments in this entire movie is when Stephen Lang is trying to tell Kurt Russell to turn Powers Booth loose, and Kurt Russell points a gun right at his head and says, anybody makes a move, I turn your head into a canoe. And Thomas Hayden Church goes, he's bluffing. He goes, nope, he ain't bluffing.
I don't think he's bluffing. It's so good. The look in his eyes.
Oh, he knows.
And how serious he is. I don't think he's bluffing.
This is... So here's what I love about Tombstone, and why I think The Expendables, what it should have been, is a perfect analogy. Because so many different actors in this movie, this is the pinnacle of that actor.
Quintessential
of that actor. This is the best Val Kilmer you will see in any Val Kilmer movie. And I say that, I know exactly what you're going to say.
No.
It's my absolute favorite Val Kilmer.
No, you're not wrong. Like, that expression on my face was like, well, he's really great in The Saint, but that shows his range. He doesn't give a performance like he does here.
See, I thought you were going to, that's not the movie I thought would be the tipping point for you, the point of contention. I thought it was going to be Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which I think is his second best.
Oh, I think that's handily one of his best movies, and his performance is amazing in that movie. But The Saint actually shows it. The Saint's not a great movie, but The Saint's a great movie for seeing Val Kilmer's talent, because the way he slips into all those different characters while he's impersonating them as, you know, as a spy, is fucking phenomenal. Like, he's just great. His range in that movie is unreal, and he's never done anything like that before or since.
So we've said The Saint three times. Take a drink.
No.
Okay.
No, we may have to cover that movie eventually, but I need to revisit that movie to see if it's worth talking about. But his performance is great. But no, this is handily, this is the one he should have gotten an Oscar for.
I agree 100%.
This is like, this is that kind of a movie, Ed, because every bit of dialogue that comes out of his mouth is fucking amazing.
Now, this movie just barely grazed the plot here. This is a movie about the Earp brothers moving to Tombstone, Arizona. It's based loosely, but actually not as loosely as you would think.
Loosely.
Okay, you say loosely, but
Hold on, loosely.
Don't let go of that idea, because I'm gonna hit you with some knowledge here in a minute.
Oh, we'll talk. This is going to be the big point of contention. Like, this is why I've hated this movie for 23 years.
This movie is based upon famous legendary lawman Wyatt Earp and his brothers, making the move to Tombstone, Arizona. Now, Tombstone is the place where the showdown at the OK Corral happened, which, even if you know nothing about Westerns, even if you know nothing about the history of America in the late 1800s, you've heard of the OK Corral. It is that legendary. You've heard of Wyatt Earp. You've heard of Doc Holliday. These are touchstones in our American history. Our collective American history, and which is hilarious because I think this movie was actually made by Touchstone. And that's what makes this film immediately so accessible to everyone, I feel, is that we know this story, but we kind of don't know this story. So the movie starts with the Earp brothers showing up in Tombstone. They don't want it, they've been lawmen, they don't want to be lawmen anymore. They just want to be successful businessmen. Unfortunately, they happen to ride into town at the same time as the cowboy gang led by Powers Booth, which again, the cowboys, American history, are not the heroic figures that we have kind of extrapolated them to be. They were a gang of outlaws. So
yeah, the word cowboy was
been reappropriated.
The word cowboy was not a word that was used positively in this era. It was a name of a gang.
Yeah.
What we call a cowboy now is called a cowhand, or a rancher. You weren't called a cowboy. Cowboys were a group of rustlers and thieves and bandits who are represented in this film.
Yeah.
Let me lay out my issue while we go into this, because my issue was, I lived in Arizona during some formative years of my life. I lived there for 3 years.
Cargo, there is no Arizona.
When I was a teenager. This is Arizona. I lived in Tucson, Arizona. And this is where I had my first paper route, where all that money went to comic books and role-playing games and going to see movies, like and renting VHS. Like, that's where every penny of my paper route money went. And so I watched a lot of movies, read a lot of comic books, played a lot of games, living in Arizona during this time. And there's nothing really to see in Arizona except Tombstone. And I went to Tombstone 3 times over the course of my 3 years living there. I've stood in the OK Corral in the place where these men were gunned down. I've stood in all the spots where everyone was gunned down. You have spent time in the town, and they show all sorts of like documentaries on the event. So I was really, really very familiar with the story of the showdown at the OK Corral and the Earp's Vengeance ride when I saw this movie, and was really bothered by the fact that what would be ordinarily a really great Western that I'd never question was drawing a lot of power from the fact that it's based on a true story, and it was getting so many of the details really, really wrong. Like, there was just a lot that they exaggerated that I felt didn't need to be exaggerated. And that was a problem that I had when I watched it, and I held on to that so long that I did not watch this movie again since it came out. And that's why I really, in recent years, felt like, you know, everybody loves this fucking movie. I really owe it another shot. I need to get over my shit and watch it as a Western instead of watching it as a based on a true story, and which is what I did last night, and loved the fuck out of it. Really, really enjoy the shit out of this movie. Like, I always liked the performances before, but I just was bothered by what they changed and how unnecessary I felt that it was. But God damn it, is it a good fucking Western.
It's so, so good. And no small part of that is, as we mentioned, the caliber of the cast that they put together. What I find interesting about your issue with the movie, and I think you might be uniquely suited to speak to the authenticity of the, like, in a way that I didn't anticipate anyone would be able to speak to the authenticity of this, is that George B. Cosmatos and the makers of this movie really strove for authenticity. And while they may have changed things that, you know, stuck in your craw for sure, you know, lines of dialogue during the OK Corral shootout, the actual sequence of events during that moment, the costumes that they're wearing, the lingo that they're using, all of this was said to be authentic to the actual event and events and how they happen. So even if, and I'll defer to you because I don't know American history and I certainly have never lived in Arizona, but even if the efforts, even if the ends of these means were that they didn't get everything quite right, I respect the fact that they really strove for that authenticity right down to the costuming, to the production design. They really were trying to get that right.
Yeah, no, and that stuff they is all to my knowledge correct. It has to do with certain like details of what happened. Like the shootout at the OK Corral is historically accurate. We know exactly how that went down. That's well documented, and that's exactly as it is presented, at least for what we know. No, but it's where the movie, the thing is that the first two thirds of the movie gets the story pretty much right. Mm-hmm. Like the changes are like, who cares? Like, Curly, isn't the leader of the Cowboys. Johnny Ringo was actually in history the leader of the Cowboys. Curly was just another member of the gang. Like, who cares that,
right.
You know, that's not a big detail. Everything after, one of the Earps gets shot, though. And I'm blanking on the name of the brother that got shot. What his first name was. Everything after that is mostly exaggerated to the point of silliness. The big historical contention, the thing they didn't get right, was during the Vengeance ride, there were only four of the Cowboys were killed. Only four Cowboys get killed. And Johnny Ringo wasn't one of them. Johnny Ringo went on to live well past that and then died in another way entirely. He wasn't gunned down by Doc Holliday at all. Everything after they go out on the Vengeance ride is entirely fiction. And if you take it as fiction, it's really great fiction because it's a really great fucking story.
Yes.
But it's not at all what happened. In fact, there's no actual historical documentation that the four Cowboys that were killed were actually killed by the Earps and his group. That's something else we were mentioning, all these people. Like, randomly, a couple of Cowboys are like, we heard what happened to the women, so we're going to join you. And it's Michael fucking Rooker.
Michael fucking Rooker!
Like, Rooker shows up and like, yeah, I'm one of the good guys now. It's like, hey, Michael Rooker!
We also didn't mention that the mayor of Tombstone is played by Terry O'Quinn.
Yeah, no, like, it's literally all the small, like, these small characters just wander in. It's like, hi, I'm Terry O'Quinn. I'm just going to show up for a scene and then I'll come back
later.
It's
like an all-you-can-eat junk food buffet, yeah. This movie.
And we just mentioned the men. Like, the women in this movie, they're a great cast. But, of course, you know, the scene stealer is Dana Delaney, you know, at the height of her powers in the early 90s. Just fucking phenomenal. My real problem with this movie at the time was the historical inaccuracy of that third act, because the shootout at the OK Corral is such a pinnacle, like, as you said, touchstone event of Western mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And the characters involved with it were so larger than life. You know, Doc Holliday was a, you know, notorious asshole.
Yeah.
The Earps were, you know, really well-known alpha male, kind of jackasses, but likable jackasses. And these, you know, these villains, you know, these people like, you know, fucking Johnny Ringo, these are notorious fucking badasses. You know, Johnny Ringo takes part in another great, you know, bit of Western history with the Hoodoo War, which is where he started off.
He do?
It's called the Hoodoo War. What it was called, the Hoodoo War.
He do. Okay.
Hoodoo, the Hoodoo War, which is actually, like, it's also in history, they refer to it as the Mason County War, but it was called the Hoodoo War.
Ladies and gentlemen, gather around the hearth for this lesson from Grandpa Cargill on how the West was won.
Grandpa Cargill, who was born in fucking Texas and lived in Arizona and grew up with Old West mythology,
I feel like,
as part of my background.
Okay, that tears it. We are going to program a month at some point. Take all of the drink. Take the whole bottle, because I just figured out we're going to do a month of what I'm going to call Besterns, where we just talk about our favorite Westerns.
The ones we haven't covered yet that we need to cover.
Yeah.
We absolutely, because, you know, Westerns are at a core of Westerns are at the core of my storytelling. A lot of my stories, particularly, you know, anything, if I ever write anything that's an adventure, like my novels or anything like that, the structure is usually borrowed from Westerns.
I always thought Bagul was kind of a black hat. So, yeah, no, that totally came across to me. Hey-o.
I'm fascinated by the Western mythology and the Western myth making, and I love Westerns. And this is a really great fictional Western. Is a really terrible adaptation of the real history, which makes me sad, because that's the thing is, you know, watching this again made me recontextualize it, because there's this great old story. There's this great old saying by John Ford, master of the Western.
Of course. Searchers and
then
some.
You have a choice between telling the truth and telling the legend, print the legend. Like that was, you know, the saying, and that's been a great storytelling thing for a long time. But John Ford grew up in an age without an internet.
Yeah.
And now that we live in the internet age, storytelling can be ruined by the truth. Like there's a really great movie from a few years back called Rush, which I really enjoyed. And as soon as I was done watching Rush,
the Ron Howard movie?
Yeah.
About Anatole Sena?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I immediately went to the internet, wanted to find out more about these guys, and found out that a huge chunk of the movie was bullshit.
See, that's crazy, because just a couple years before Rush came out, an amazing documentary called Sena came out that couldn't help but tell the real story, because it was literally told half of it from the perspective of a camera mounted on his car.
Well, yeah, but the thing is that it was, you know, with that movie in particular, what they did was they wanted to tell the better story, and the better story leaves out the fact that they were roommates in their early years together, and that they were friends, like they lived together for a couple of years, and that they were actually close. Like once you find that out, what happens later in life isn't as
it doesn't
seem as magnanimous. It's not like two villains become, you know, two nemeses become friends, you know, after a terrible accident. Is a much better story than two guys who are really good friends end up being really good to each other after something terrible happens to one of them. It's not as great a story. And so once you find that, it's like, oh, well, I don't want to go back and watch that bullshit version of that movie again. It's like if you're going to be inspired by those events, take those events and turn it into something else, you know, something like what I felt Ty West brilliantly did with The Sacrament. Where he didn't feel he could do justice in a 2-hour film to Jonestown. Mm-hmm. He decided to make a movie based on the concept of Jonestown and tell his own fictionalized version of that story, and made a brilliant story of it. And he captures the concept of that event without doing an injustice to any part of the story. And I feel like that had you changed the names here, if these aren't the Earps, if you just change the names of everyone in this movie, you end up with an amazing Western that doesn't need to be based on a true story in order for you to fall in love with this story. And so that's what bugged me about this. But going and rewatching it and accepting, going in, going, look, I know it's not the true story. Let me watch it just as fiction. It's fucking great fiction. And I really hate myself for not having watched it for 23 years.
Well, what I find interesting about your issue with the movie is that it had sort of a troubled production, in that the original director and writer was a guy named Kevin Jarre. And he wrote a script that was much longer than the final product of the movie, and was intended to be epic. It was going to detail the lives of all the combatant parties in the story. So it was going to go in depth into the real story of all these people. But when he was fired and Cosmatos was brought on, he brought in his own screenwriter to trim the script to focus just on the Earp family. So I'm wondering if somewhere the original script for this movie might address some of the inaccuracies that you had a problem with. I mean, I guess we'll never know, but it's considering that it was supposed to be epic, it was supposed to be this much longer delve into the lives of everyone involved in the OK Corral, maybe it would have addressed those inaccuracies.
It might have, yeah. But
again, one of the things that Cosmatos, when he was promoting this movie, mentioned again and again, and I think is so appropriate to what we're talking about, is he boasted that all the lightning and all the mustaches in this movie are real. And it's like,
that's fucking cool as shit.
That is cool. And it's like, but when you hear something like that, it's so to me encapsulates what I like about this movie, in that, yes, the things that you're mentioning are probably inaccurate. But when you hear something like the lightning and the mustaches are real, everything else is like, who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares? Who cares about everything else? The mustaches and the lightning are real.
Those mustaches are fucking epic, though.
They are so, God,
and
Kurt Russell,
I was actually,
man.
You know, oddly enough, I didn't know that the lightning was real. I actually really, really dug the lightning.
Oh, it's so perfect.
Like, it just, it really, it, like, it's, like, you can tell, like, so much lightning in movies is just a lightning machine. Like, it's literally just, you know, this light that just flashes, and you can tell.
Yeah.
And sometimes it looks really bad. And this lightning in particular looked pretty fucking great. And yes. I was like, wow, I love the coloring on that. Like, it just feels, it feels like Arizona lightning. Because Arizona lightning is very different than, like, Arizona lightning is very purple. It is very, you know, it's that kind of, like, raging storm. Because it doesn't rain and thunderstorm often in Arizona. And when it does, it's usually the monsoon season, or it's a rare big storm. And when it does, it is a big fuck all storm.
Arizona lightning, by the way, I'm not convinced wasn't a Burt Reynolds movie at some point. Have we not seen Arizona lightning?
I kind of want to see Arizona lightning.
Directed by?
Hal Needham. It has to be. Hal Needham never did any of those movies that we're kind of just joking about at the moment, but wouldn't it have been cool if he did?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because they weren't making movies together at that point yet.
No.
Hal Needham was still a stuntman at that point.
True story. But this is really, this is the lightning in Tombstone in the movie is so good that you would accuse it of being fake.
Yeah.
And by that, I don't just mean the visual quality. But when it hits, and like the moments that it punctuates, you would totally accuse this fucking lightning of being false, of being added after the fact.
Yeah. If it's all legit, then that's awesome. If he's telling the truth, then that's great. Of course, the mustaches are amazing. The mustaches are distracting at points. Like, oh, dude, that Kurt Russell's mustache bisects his face in a way that makes him nigh unrecognizable.
That's the first time anyone said the mustaches are distracting, and they're not talking about East 6th Street in Austin. That's very interesting.
Although, the best thing about it is Sam Elliott decided to keep his. Like, everybody grew them, and everybody got rid of them afterwards, except for Sam Elliott, who's like, I think I rock this, and he fucking does.
And from that point on, anytime you hear his voice, you can hear the mustache in his voice.
And by the way, this is the first of two Sam Elliott movies we're going to talk about this month.
Holy shit, it is.
Like, we've got more. We have more Sam Elliott coming. And these are, I would argue that these are two of Sam Elliott's best characters.
I would agree with that.
I mean, like, well, I mean, best movies. Because his character isn't too deep in this movie. This really is, if there's anything that Tombstone suffers from, it is...
Not enough Elliott.
Well, not enough of everybody.
Like, well, but that, I mean, but that's like...
But not enough Elliott is like, yeah, there's
you
like
have a Kurt bottleneck of greatness in this movie.
That's what I'm saying is if this movie has one major flaw, it's that I would have wanted to see another half an hour or an hour of these characters. Like, I want to see more Powers Booth. Michael Biehn, oh my God, does he fucking steal the show whenever he shows up?
Yeah.
Like, he broods magnificently in this movie. Him in the opening of this film, like when he starts like lambasting the guy for the bad translation, like that moment is just so great.
Yeah.
The only people we feel like we have a full meal of in this movie is Kurt Russell and Val Kilmer.
Yeah.
There's not enough Bill Paxton in this movie. There's not enough Powers Booth in this movie. I kind of want some more Stephen Lang in this fucking movie.
I could have done with a tinge more Terry O'Quinn. I could have done with a tinge more. Oh, no. I could have done
Billy
with
Zane.
I was going to say a dollop more Billy Zane.
And you know what? Let me talk about this for a moment, because here's one of the interesting things about this movie that I did not catch in 1993. Oh, my God, the gay subplot in this movie.
Oh, my God. Like, oh, my God. It's so good.
The boldness for it for a Western, a mainstream Western in 1993.
Not only that, exactly. What's crazy about it, it's twofold. It's like that's a bold topic to cover considering the setting of the movie. It's a bold topic to cover considering the release date of this movie.
Yes. And yeah, it's like what you have to keep in mind in 1993, that was not considered okay.
Right.
That was really not considered okay. And, and that, which, thank God, fucking changed. But you hear these stories about this particular group of people in the 90s called the Gay Mafia. And you hear about, you know, people, you know, talking about the gay agenda and putting gayness into movies. And it's like, I'm really glad they fucking did. Mm-hmm. The way it's dealt with here is so sweet and so simple and so subtle. That little small bit with Billy Zane and Jason Priestley is so touching.
Yeah.
And
well, because it's heartbreaking because, you know, the Cowboys are giving Jason Priestley such a hard time throughout this whole movie. They're calling him Sister Boy. But there's one or two members of them that are like, and Powers Booth is... That's another fascinating relationship, is Powers Booth and Jason Priestley.
Yeah.
Because Powers Booth has this weird protective, kind of fatherly relationship with Jason Priestley, where the other guys call him Sister Boy and are razzing him. He's like, hey, come sit by me. It's fine. And then when Billy Zane, the actor, comes to Tombstone, Jason Priestley is just enamored of him. And his death is the reason... and when the Cowboys blame the Earps for the death of Billy Zane's character, that's when Jason Priestley just kind of breaks with him and says, I don't want to talk to you. You're not my friends. And he does. He basically is. No. I'm sorry. I have that backwards.
Yeah.
It's when the Earps kill Thomas Hayden Church's character, that he's like, you know, those are my friends and I'm not talking to you guys. But then when the actor Billy Zane dies, that's when he breaks from the Cowboys and it's just like, I can't be a part of this anymore.
Yeah.
And you, because it's of that subtle relationship.
And there's that great touching moment. Like, that's just where he like grabs it. He holds his hand and that's the moment where you realize, oh, that's what this is.
Yeah.
And it's such a great subtle moment. And it doesn't surprise me that I didn't catch it at the time, but man, rewatching this movie, did that moment particularly hit me as just one of the, just like one of the really great heartfelt moments of this movie, and just how much care this movie takes to make us care about so many different small characters in this movie, and that they don't paint all of the cowboys as these brash, brusque bullies. Like that, there's something else going on with them. They are real.
Johnny
characters.
Ringo speaks Latin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and the it's great argument easy. They have in Latin is so cool.
I looked up exactly the translation of that argument, what each individual phrase that they say to each other means.
You don't speak Latin?
I don't, because I
actually speak Latin.
Yeah, well, you're old.
well, yeah, I remember it from when I was a kid.
Yeah, when you were growing up in Arizona, no, when it was being settled.
Everybody takes one language. I took Latin, so like that scene... one time this is actually the one movie this skill becomes useful.
All right, here we go then. Junk Food Cinema first. We're going to have a Latin quiz for Cargill right here on the show.
Oh, great.
First one's pretty easy. Even I know this one. So Doc Holliday says, in vino veritas, which means?
In wine we trust?
Yeah, in wine there is truth.
Yeah.
Then Johnny Ringo says, age quod agis, which means?
That one, that's the one I've forgotten, actually.
It's do what you do.
Yeah.
Doc Holliday then says, credat Judaeus appella, non ego.
God damn it. See, now that...
I love that beer has completely made all of the years of Latin. He says, credat Judaeus appella.
I was watching the movie last night, and I'm drinking. I was like, oh, yeah, no. I was right along with the conversation, and now...
Let appella the Jew believe, not I... To which Johnny Ringo says...
yeah, because that's from the Bible.
Iuventus... this is just me not being able to read this. Stultorum magister.
Repeat that phrase?
Iuventus. Stultorum magister.
That's the master... something. Yeah.
Youth is the master of fools.
Yeah.
Doc Holliday says, in pace requiescat.
God damn it.
Which means may he rest in peace.
Fuck this whole section. I thought I remember. You know what? I mistranslated all of that last night when I was drunk and watching this movie again.
Hey, finito. Finito.
Finito.
Finito. Well, that was fun, kids.
That was. That's what 20 years out of high school will do for you.
But here's what I think echoes your point about the talent bottleneck in this film. Is that we've been talking for half an hour and we've still barely scratched the surface of Val Kilmer in this movie, which is to this day the reason I think, as much as I love Kurt Russell, as much as he is a personal hero of mine, the reason I watch this movie is Val Kilmer.
Well, yeah, Russell is playing, you know, the troubled alpha male, you know.
But a very Kurt Russell typical hero in that he is the most moral good. You know what I mean? Like, he is, like, upstanding.
He tries.
No, but he's super upstanding in this movie.
Yeah.
To the point that his, I guess you would call it an emotional affair with Josephine. He is trying to resist her
yes.
at every turn. And, in fact, it's not until his own wife leaves him that he really pursues the relationship with her. So even in that regard, he is the most upstandingly moral good in this movie, whereas Val Kilmer is the rogue. Val Kilmer is the guy who, as you mentioned from some of the cowboys, is just... I'm sorry, as you mentioned that in history, the Earps actually were. Everything the Earps may have been in history is what Val Kilmer is in this movie. He is a lovable dick. Just a giant cockknocker that we can't help but... And his brash Southern gentleman accent that he's got going on throughout the whole movie, where he says things like, you know, I have not yet begun to defile myself.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I love everything he says in this movie.
Everything he says in this movie is fucking phenomenal. Although, the simplest thing that he says is probably the clenched fist of who he is, which is...
Let me guess. Can I guess?
Yeah.
When Wyatt Earp says to him, you don't have to get involved in this, and he says, that is a hell of a thing for you to say to me.
No.
Damn it.
Actually, right. But no, that again, that's really great. No, my favorite Huckleberry moment is when the guy's like, you shouldn't be out here, you shouldn't be doing this, and he goes, well, Wyatt's my friend, and he goes, well, I got lots of friends.
I don't.
Oh,
like, it's I so don't. Good.
It's like that moment right there defines everything he does in this movie with them. Like, everything he does, which he knows he shouldn't be doing, comes from that one statement, and it's so powerful. And it's
that line's a daisy. That line is a daisy.
Yeah. No, I've always loved his performance in this movie, and I've always loved his portrayal. But now, watching this movie with this, you know, with this fresh sense, I really just connect with it and see why everybody else loves this fucking movie so much. And I cannot express how angry I am at myself that I carried that around for 23 fucking years. And like, no, fuck that movie. That's not the truth. It's not the wow. Fucking watch the movie without the truth. Like, stop being
this
such
is a moment of redemption.
Stop
for you.
Being an uptight asshole about it. And just fucking embrace. Well, this is the reason you and I started Junk Food Cinema. Like, this is when we were sitting here on these couches like 3 years ago, and you were talking to me about wanting to do something like this, I was just like, you know what, this will give me an excuse to go and watch movies I haven't watched, or rewatch movies that I haven't given a chance to, or maybe give a chance to a movie that I've been, you know, haven't given the proper go, because I'll do that sometimes. I'll just be like, you know what, I don't like that movie, but other people do, let me watch it again and see if I still like. And a lot of times it's like, oh yeah, no, still hate this movie. Or sometimes I'm like, yeah, I love this. But this movie in particular, was the reason we had not done this was because I would never bring it up, because it was a movie that I just didn't like. And I was like, you know what? Let's. And when I was floating it to you last week, I thought it was off mic. And you're like, fuck it, we're doing it. I was like, oh shit, I guess. Yep. And you're like, we're doing it next week. I was like, all right, it's in. Let's do it. Like, there's no pulling out now. And I was like, I was worried about it all week, because I'm like, what if I still don't like this movie? Like, what if it? I'm like, I'm sure I'll like something about it, so at least I'll be able to talk about it, and at least be able to say, well, I don't like the history of it or whatever. But man, rewatching it, god damn it, this fucking movie. This movie is really great, and the only filmmaking flaw with the movie, like we talked about the problem where you just need it's choked with talent. Is there are like two moments in the film where it's clear that they cut stuff out, and it just jumps in a way that it shouldn't jump. And it's just like one, you know, we're in the bar, it's late at night, he's interacting with Dana Delaney, and the next thing you know, he's on his horse and he's riding down. It's like, oh, guess who's here? It's like, oh yeah, we're following this story. And it feels a little too forced in a way that I'm certain it wasn't written, because it's too convenient in terms of storytelling. And I feel like, oh yeah, there was probably a scene or two that got dropped there, and they're like, we really need to move this part along.
Yeah.
And it's 2 hours and 9 minutes, as is.
And because this is one of those rare movies where, I mean, it's two films in one.
It really is.
In any other movie, the OK Corral would have been the end of the movie.
And yeah, no.
It would have been the finale of the film. But in this movie, it's the turning point of the film, where the second movie starts.
Oh yeah. No, this movie... oddly enough, this movie, the moment where we get what would be the end of the first act is like at minute 50.
Yeah.
Like this movie, this movie is like moving along and it's not really going anywhere for 50 minutes. Like stuff's happening and it's all great. But structurally speaking, it's just these guys kind of getting set up in town and we don't have the incident where with the cowboys, which is what drives the engine of this fucking movie, until minute 50. And it's very odd. Straight, you would not find a movie like that happening like this in current Hollywood. They would be like, we got to have the thing with the cowboys happen 25 minutes sooner. You got to get that 25 minutes sooner. We can't, like, this is all great and all, but we don't need to see them setting up in town. Maybe we cut them getting off the train. Maybe, I don't know. What do we, that? No, there's nothing here that's fat. It's all essential. It's all great character building. It's, you know, our villains are set up really well right at the beginning. It moves along and you're with it. But the conflict doesn't really kick in until minute 50. Mm-hmm. But once it does, then it's, you know, a ramp up to the OK Corral. And that's fucking fantastic. And then it's, you know, the purging of the cowboys, you know, the vengeance ride, which cinematically is really well fucking done. And it's really good. And it's really, you know, that great final fight with Johnny Ringo is so fantastic. Like, fuck the fact that it has no historical accuracy whatsoever. It's just a great fucking turn of events. Mm-hmm. And like when Doc Holliday steps out from the bushes and it's like, I'm your Huckleberry.
Yeah.
You know, when that he's like, we never finished our argument. Well, that was just drunk talk.
He says, I was just funning, and Doc Holliday says, I wasn't. Oh, it's so good.
And it is. It's so great.
I want to speak to a couple more things, because you mentioned the accuracy again, and one of the things I think is interesting is that Val Kilmer's last line in this movie, before Doc Holliday dies of consumption, is, I'll be damned, which historians have agreed was, in fact, Doc Holliday's real last words. And also, the moment where where Wyatt Earp, Kurt Russell, steps out and kills Curly Bill and just walks up to him as he's shooting at him was actually confirmed by a member right after that happens in the movie. Wyatt Earp kills like two or three other members of the Cowboys. Well, one of the members that he kills in real life, that cowboy didn't die of his injuries. And in the hospital he didn't die outright, but when he died of his injuries at the hospital before he died, he told the story of what happened, and it was, in fact, that Wyatt Earp just walked into a hail of gunfire from Curly Bill and just unloaded both barrels of a shotgun at him fearlessly. So, I mean, and there's a direct descendant of one of the Earps working on the crew of this movie.
Yeah.
So it's like, again, the mustaches and the lightning is real.
Well, and there's other connections as well, like Harry Carey Jr. plays the old-timey sheriff of Tombstone at first, and his dad, Harry Carey, was a famous early Western actor who was one of Wyatt Earp's pallbearers. Mm-hmm. Like, this movie's like rife with these connections. Like, yeah, no, there's a love for this legend. I'm surprised that they took the legend in the direction that it went. But of course, this is this era of Hollywood. And this is actually the end of an era in Hollywood. Like, this movie came out in 93, and this was the end of this era before the indie boom would take over and Hollywood would kind of flounder for 10 years going, what are we supposed to be doing right now? Like, they didn't quite get it, because everything that was hitting was, you know, darker, and it was all these indie directors coming out and doing stuff. And Hollywood was in this very weird place. And it was also one of the last, you know, movies of this era made before the internet became a thing. You know, Google would not happen for another 6 years after this. So looking up things like, hey, who was Johnny Ringo, and being able to sift through Wikipedia for a couple hours over these characters and reading the actual, you know, stories of what these guys, you know, did and finding the historical accuracy of it was something you just couldn't do.
Yeah.
And so it was very easy for people to watch a movie like this and not know, you know, where they, you know, stuff, the real stuff, like the, you know, when Earp killed Curly, Versus, you know, the, well, there, it says there were 100 cowboys and they went on the ride and they killed most of them, right? And it's like, no, they killed four of them.
Yeah.
Like, no, they did not. There were not, there was but not, it, but the Vengeance ride,
it
they
makes
were
for a
out
much better
looking
movie.
For these guys, but they didn't exactly kill a whole mess of guys, as many guys as the movie would lead you to believe, or that the movie even shows you on screen. So, but it does make for a great story.
And I love just the whole, like, the manly aspect of, you know, these are the Earps. They're famous lawmen who have killed, you know, their share of outlaws. But they've got that Michael Corleone thing going on in Godfather 3 where they don't want to get involved. They're trying to be out of it. They're trying, through the first act of this movie, to not get involved in you know, law enforcement at all. They just want to retire. They want to be rich businessmen. And slowly they each get pulled back into it. And that's a really fascinating to me. And you build up these villains enough to where you can see why, you know, they would have a problem with the Earps, why the Earps would have a problem with them, why it would lead Virgil back first, and then it would lead Bill Paxton's, the brother Bill Paxton plays, back in. And then, you know, when that goes down, then it's, God, I love the moment where the cowboys are riding through town and Virgil and Bill Paxton have both become lawmen. And Wyatt has resisted and resisted and resisted. And finally, when he sees the cowboys riding through town, he knows the shit's about to go down. He says,
"Probably you should probably swear me.
Go ahead and swear me in just for good measure." And it's like, oh, yes. It's like he's been pulled back. God, it's everything that I wish all Westerns were. Like, there are Westerns that I love. But when I watch the Westerns that are really dry and really poorly paced and just gets, you know, slogged down by this kind of thing, I want all these Westerns to be Tombstone. This is the kind of the benchmark, the litmus test by which I judge a lot of Westerns, and I absolutely love it. And again, as we mentioned, just chock full of junk food cinema all-stars. And here's a weird connection. We covered Abominable Dr. Fibes a few weeks ago. Before he died, Vincent Price, at the request of a personal friend, narrated a brief history of Tombstone, which was called Tombstone, the Town Too Tough to Die, for a diorama at the site of the OK Corral gunfight. So it's a 20-minute piece that he did in a single take, and it's just his narration that to this day, in Tombstone, Arizona, they use at the spot of the OK Corral shootout. That's fucking bizarre to me, that they got Vincent Price to narrate the history of the OK Corral for a... Can you imagine your
well, having been there?
Yeah, so you've been there.
I've been there. I totally get it. Like that, there is, if you are ever in Arizona and you're doing tourism stuff, swing by Tombstone. It is a really cool little place. Like they really do. It really is mired in the history of the Old West. It's why the town exists. It's totally the tourist trap you think it is. At least it was when I was there. I remember every time I'd go there, I'd go into the saloon and have a sarsaparilla.
Because
I was, you know, as a kid. Maybe I need to go there now and actually have a proper beer instead of just a sarsaparilla. But
to be fair, in a dirty glass.
Yeah. But it is a really cool place. And once you're there, and like I said, when you stand in the spot where you know these legends died, you know, where you grew up hearing the story of the OK Corral, and you're standing in the spot, it's got to be like, you know, I mean, it doesn't really exist in the way that it did, but if you were able to stand in the spot where Leonidas and his 300 Spartans stood at Thermopylae, you know, unfortunately, because of the way that is, that spot's actually moved because of geology in a way that it's not exactly as it was. But if you could stand there and know this is the spot where Leonidas died, like, it is profound. It is just, you know, I'm standing where legends stood. And then, of course, you know, the realization that these legends were just men, and we just tell this story because it is a story of our history. It is a really interesting thing, and knowing that Vincent Price was a fan of history, and I can't imagine that he would not want to do that. Like, why would you not want to narrate this thing that you know that tens of thousands of tourists are going to come through, and that you're going to be telling this story, and especially someone with a voice like Vincent Price, to be telling this, Vincent Price telling a story of these famous deaths. Of course he was, mm-hmm. you know, it's really, I think that's awesome. I have not seen that one, because that happened after I've seen it. Now I want to go back and see Vincent Price narrating this thing.
And what I also find interesting as I was researching this is that a lot of different sources have said that George Cosmatos was sort of a ghost director or sort of a figurehead director, and that when Kevin Jarre was fired, Kurt Russell ended up doing a lot of the directing on this. So I've
heard that story over the years as well.
So I'm interested. I think that's fascinating. But you know, as much as I love the catalog, and it's weird to say the oeuvre of Cosmatos, like I'm okay believing either one. But this is a movie, like we said, that exists in two parts. That is one of the most macho movies of all time. It is one of the greatest westerns I've ever seen, and it suffers, if anything, from just having a bottleneck of too much talent in the movie, which is a problem I think most movies would love to have. And I also want to point out, we talk a lot about Stephen Lang because he is, you know, if we had a Junk Food Hall of Fame, he would definitely be inducted, if for no other reason than this year alone, but apparently was drunk the entire time he was on set for this movie, which I just want to consider method.
I'm hoping
it's just method acting.
I'm hoping it's method and not that it was a dark period of his history.
Yeah.
But God damn it, again, he acted circles around everyone.
It's true. And someone who's not even seen in the movie, this is when we talk about the bottleneck of talent in this film, someone who is not even seen on screen, Robert Mitchum, is one of my favorite actors of all time. See Night of the Hunter, see the original Cape Fear, see literally any movie that Robert Mitchum was in. And one of the things that I think is fantastic is he was actually signed on to star as a character called Old Man Clanton. He was going to be the patriarch of the Clanton gang, but on the first day of shooting, he fell off his horse and injured his back. So not only did they basically take him out of the movie, but Robert Mitchum is so fucking good that they just took that character out of the movie, then try and recast it and made him the narrator. And his gruff, you know, very, his voice that sounds like the Old West itself carries us through this movie and has a very, speaking of the biblical references in this movie, the last line spoken by anyone in Tombstone is Robert Mitchum's narration, and the narration, the last line of the movie, Tom Mix wept. Talk about biblical. The last line of this movie, Tom Mix wept.
It's funny you bring that up. It reminds me of this other thing. This movie came out the exact same year that Wayne's World 2 came out.
Okay. I was like, you're going somewhere with this.
I'm going somewhere.
I know you are.
And in
I'm your Huckleberry. Let's go.
There is a scene where he stops by a gas station to get directions.
Charlton Heston.
I know this isn't a big role, but can we get someone better than this? And they bring in Charlton Heston to do this line of dialogue, and it's a great gag. This comes out that same year where Charlton Heston essentially does the same thing here.
Hi, I'm Hooper.
Hi, yeah. It's just like they show up at the ranch, and Charlton Heston comes out.
It would not be.
And I just kind of want to put that same line in there where I know this isn't a big role, but can we get someone a little bit? And here's Charlton Heston.
I know we've hired literally the entire Screen Actors Guild, but can we get somebody bigger to play Hooper? It would not be Junk Food Cinema if we didn't end our episode on Tombstone by making a wild reference to Wayne's World 2. Digging into the potatoes if ever we dug into the potatoes.
Well, welcome to Junk Food Cinema, my friend. Yeah, but that is what this scene is, and it's really but God, the thing is that every time somebody walks through the door in this movie, it's either one of our legends, you know, a junk food legend, like a great fucking character actor, or it's a legitimate fucking cinema legend.
Yeah.
Like, it's just every bit of this movie is it's just laden with it. And there is no other Western like it.
Yes.
Like, there are Westerns that are kind of like it. Like, you look at something like the amazing cast in The Quick and the Dead that was, it's just like
the biggest, the closest I would compare to this, honestly.
Well, the biggest star in that movie at the time was Sharon Stone.
Yeah.
Like she was like, and everyone else were all these, you know, either young and upcoming actors or character actors where it's like, okay, well, and Gene Hackman is big, but he's kind of getting up there. And then it's like, well, we've got this young kid who was nominated for an Oscar, you know,
Leo something.
And then of course, well, there's this Australian guy that something might come of that. We'll get him to play the blind priest.
I've always thought about this. I've always thought if you took movies with huge ensemble casts made 20 years ago and you had to rebill it today. In other words, you had to start putting the names on the poster, which ones you would pick. Quick and the Dead is an amazing movie to use for that game.
Oh, yeah, because it's so weird where it's like, you know, oh, yeah. Leo DiCaprio and Russell Crowe, but they aren't the main characters in this movie. They're just these side characters. They're great, and they're fucking great side characters.
Honestly, I was thinking about this. If that movie came out in 2004, it would have been Leo DiCaprio, Russell Crowe. I guarantee you third build would have been Tobin Bell because Saw had just hit, was a huge sensation. Tobin Bell would have been third build in 2004.
In Lance Henriksen's in
that. Yes, yes.
Keith
David's in that movie.
Yeah, there's such a great hit, but that doesn't even come close to this. And like with something like Unforgiven, where it was deliberate, where it's like we deliberately took all these great actors, and they're
Look at Gene Hackman again. What the fuck are you doing here?
Yeah, well, he did a couple of westerns in that period of time. Another one I would come close to. I would say comes really close. You know, it's another one that's fun with that is Silverado.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about Silverado to me is the Diet Tombstone.
It is. No, the thing with Silverado is probably the closest to the Magnificent Seven that any other Western in that era comes, because it has the fun of Magnificent Seven. That, you know, Unforgiven, not a fun movie. Unforgiven.
Oh, is it not?
Amazing. Not a fun movie. Tombstone. Really great. I think it has great moments of fun to it, but it doesn't have that tongue-in-cheek kind of fun.
And you know why? But here's why. It's sort of a byproduct of what this movie is. The reason it's not as fun is because they make you care so much about characters that end up getting fucking blown away. Like, Bill Paxton's death in this movie is heart-wrenching. Like, and that's one of the, like, you can't fault the movie for not being fun. It's not because it's too serious or it's intentionally dour or they're just like they're being heavy handed. It's because they make you care about so many characters. And it's just like mathematically, you know, not everyone's making it out of this movie.
Yeah.
And that's actually a testament to how great this movie is.
No, and it's really great. So Silverado, I think it's unfair to call it Diet Tombstone. I feel like it's because it's going for something very different. Like this is a nice
Tombstone
blend.
Zero.
What?
Tombstone Zero?
No, I feel like, you know, because it really does. I find Tombstone halfway between Unforgiven and Silverado. You know, it really is kind of like the bridge between really heavy and really fun, because there are some really fun moments. Is it the scene where I think the most fun scene in this movie is the one where Billy Bob Thornton comes out with a shotgun after having just been slapped around by Wyatt Earp.
Oh, my God.
And that's where Doc Holliday realizes.
Why, Johnny Tyler?
Yeah, that whole. I'm sorry, I forgot you were there.
Oh, I'm sorry, Johnny. I forgot you were there. I have. Oh, my moment, God.
That whole scene is so much fun because he's ready to shoot this guy. And is just now finding out that it's Wyatt Earp.
He told him, I'm
Wyatt Earp. He's like, bullshit.
Yeah.
And sure enough, he's got that moment of, oh, shit. But he's still standing with the shotgun and he can't really back out really. So it's awkward and it's funny. And it's just such a good, fun scene.
God, I love that moment so much and how ineffectual Billy Bob Thornton is.
Yeah. And of course, at the time, Billy Bob Thornton was a nobody actor. Like, he had not done Sling Blade yet. So, like, nobody knew who he was. He was one of those great actors that was being put in a role because it's like, oh, we'll get Billy to do this. You know, he hadn't hit yet. So many. Terry O'Quinn was somebody who was going through the genre ringer at the time, but never really caught. You know, by this point, he had been in The Cutting Edge. He had been in Stepfather. But
I think he'd been in Rocketeer as well by this point.
But he had not. I think so. I'm pretty certain.
By 93, I think so.
Yeah. So, So yeah, but these were all these character actors who would then, of course, go on to greatness later. You know, nobody really knew Michael Rooker at this point yet. Nobody, you know, really Billy Zane hadn't hit yet because Titanic hadn't come up. In fact, he hadn't even done the role that we would fall in love with
Demon
him for.
Demon Knight.
Dude,
here's the other great thing about any movie like this. And I think this is a real, and you know, I apologize for generalizing if I am, but I think one of the things that makes a truly great guy movie is the quotability. And if you want to talk about a fucking quotable movie, Tombstone,
almost all the lines are Val Kilmer's.
Val Kilmer. And if you put more than two drinks of me in a bar, I will start quoting Doc Holliday. I'm sorry, I forgot you were there, is one I will always bust out. But
I have not yet begun to defile myself.
I said, I think there was a period, there was one summer where I think I said that every night of the week. But the greatest line in the whole movie does not belong to Doc Holliday. Sorry, I was thinking about Joan Holloway from Mad Men for a second. Freudian slip. It belongs to Wyatt Earp, because Wyatt Earp says to Ike Clanton, "You called down the thunder. Well, now you got it. You go back. You run, Kerr. You tell him I'm coming, and hell's coming with me. And then the lightning strikes, which apparently is real. And, oh, if you don't have an erection by that point watching this movie, I don't know what
Again,
to tell you.
The way Kurt Russell, like, delivered, "and hell is coming with me."
Oh.
It's just fucking phenomenal.
And just taking a spur to the side of Ike Clanton's face and just being like, "You basically go and send a message that I'm not running anywhere. Like, you woke a sleeping giant." Like, this is the Old West equivalent of Pearl Harbor. You just woke a fucking sleeping giant. You have no idea the wrath I'm about to call down upon you.
And then there's another great moment, also not Val Kilmer's. Let's hit all the great non-Val Kilmer moments for a moment.
Because otherwise this would be a two-hour podcast.
Yeah. This is done. Well,
bye.
Like, yeah, the way Powers Booth is just like so dismissive of him.
You smell that, Curly? Smells like somebody died. Fuck me. And even Curly Bill is like, Jesus, Johnny. Yeah. Like, that's what I love, is there's so many moments of like them acknowledging within the movie, like, how insane some of this stuff is. And Curly Bill just looking at Ringo like, Jesus, Johnny. Like, yeah. Oh, so good. This is one of my, like I said at the top of the show, one of my favorite movies of all time. One of the movies I go back to more than any other film in my collection.
I'm going to this is one I'm going to start revisiting more often.
Yay!
I'm a convert. I'm turned around on this. I was so fucking wrong. I was up my own ass for 23 years on this one, and
turn around, Cargill.
Well, you know, that's just, you know, a few less times that I'll end up watching Megaforce. I'll watch this instead. Because it's just so solid, and it moves so well, and it's structured so interestingly. And interesting
side note, this is the movie that for years, as a video store clerk, and you probably have this same, you have probably a different movie, but a similar story, when customers would ask you the difference between widescreen and full screen, what was the example that you gave them? Mine was always Tombstone. Because there's a great shot in this movie where after Bill Paxton dies, Wyatt Earp, Kurt Russell, wanders out on the street and it's raining and he's depressed and he's wailing. And his Josephine runs up to him and he just tells her, like, "Get away from me." And then they pan over, or they don't even pan, but like in the shot you see off to the right, his wife Maddie sees the two of them have this interaction, and instead of comforting him, she just walks away.
Yeah.
And it's another breaking point. In full screen, she's not even in the shot. And this is how I tried to explain it to people,
is
that exact scene. It was my exemplar for why you should rent widescreen movies on DVD. And now I realize you were probably in video stores before DVDs, so...
No, I was in video stores during DVD. I was a waiter before DVD. So I was there. No, the movie I would use... Oddly enough, Austin Powers, the second one, Spy Who Shagged Me.
Wow, okay, why?
Because there's a whole scene in that movie where Mini-Me is doing all this funny stuff over to the side, but there's not enough space for it in a full screen shot, so Mini-Me doesn't exist in that scene, and that scene isn't funny. So when you watch that scene, I will show the people that scene. I would show them that scene on DVD, and it would be like, "Here's Mini-Me. Watch this." And they'd be watching like, okay. And then I get done with the scene, and then I pop it in on VHS. and Mini-Me's not in the scene.
Yeah.
Like, they just, they never can, they, there's no, because you've got to focus on what's going on with
Mike Myers.
Yeah, but I was blanking on the name of the Dr.
Evil. Yeah. Lorne Michaels.
Yeah. Oh God, why did we not do Dr. Evil for this month?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question.
Dr. Evil would have been a great Mr. Doctor. But because I actually really like Goldmember, which most people don't.
What?
I would
Cargill.
Be in defense of Goldmember.
No. You've had this great character building moment where you've come around on Tombstone. Don't backtrack now by declaring your love for Goldmember. Come on.
I didn't say love. I said really like Goldmember.
That's still too much. Stay on the straight and narrow here. Let's not defile yourself before
you know
the episode
maybe,
is over.
Maybe you've just been carrying around too much hate for Goldmember for 23 years and you need to revisit Goldmember.
I have the appropriate amount of hate for Goldmember.
We'll have that conversation later. Maybe some beer and we'll watch Goldmember and see if I can bring you around on Goldmember. But
take all the drinks.
Yeah, but all the drinks.
All the drinks.
But that would be the scene that I would show. But no, that's great because that's a great emotional moment. I was showing that a scene like lacked comedy as a result. Like you were missing this entire gag that was going on. And you would see Dr. Evil turn over and look over at Mini-Me, but you didn't know what he was looking at or for. In the full screen version of that movie. So I'm so glad we just don't have to wrestle with full screen anymore.
Like, I feel like there are probably still people that buy movies in full screen, and those people should just upgrade to Blu-ray.
They're not very often offered in full screen anymore. Like, even TV is shown in widescreen, so people are used to it.
Because the TVs are now rectangular as opposed to square. So how did we get on this topic? I don't remember.
Tombstone is the movie that you would use because of that great scene. That scene was fantastic, too.
So amazing.
Yeah. But yeah, are we? Is it time?
I think it's time for the junk food pairing. This is going to be a very personal one that you may not agree with, and that's fine. But growing up, every time I watched Tombstone, I can't put my finger on why, but I always wanted Burger King. Every time I watched Tombstone, I wanted to eat Burger King. I don't know if it's because Burger King had a cheeseburger variation that was literally called the Rodeo Burger that felt very Old West. I don't know if it's because they flame broil everything and that felt very very manly. I can't tell you what it was, but every time as a kid growing up, all the way through college, that I watched Tombstone, the only thing I wanted in the whole world was Burger King. I can't explain it, but those two things became inextricably linked in my head. So that's why the junk food pairing for me is going to be Burger King, because I just, anytime I watch this movie, I wanted to have it my way, and my way meant watching Tombstone and eating fucking Burger King.
I'm going to go back to what I said earlier. I'm going to go with a sarsaparilla.
Nice. Oh my gosh.
What those of you would call root beer. but sarsaparilla was something invented, you know, and that they'd serve out in the Old West. You get a root beer. I every time I went to Tombstone, I had a sarsaparilla. So of course, for me, like when I'm watching that scene and they, you know, they're walking into the various saloons, I just kind of want, give me a sarsaparilla.
That's so weird that even though I have always loved this movie and you just kind of came around on it, we both have very personal junk food pairings for it.
Well, like I said, my reason for liking this was not about the quality of the film. It was entirely a personal thing about how they treated the
history. That's really interesting.
And how I feel about the history. Like, you know, you want to hear me go on a rant. Like, one of these days, we should probably do an episode on Friday Night Lights.
I have known you for almost a decade. I feel like I might have heard you go on a few rants before.
Yeah,
so.
But about Friday Night Lights?
No, not about Friday Night Lights. About the literally everything else in the universe, but not Friday Night Lights.
I have a very personal dislike for the movie Friday Night Lights because they get the history wrong, and the history involved actually happens to be my alma mater. So I get like I have this like 10-minute rant that I'll go on about the actual history of Friday Night Lights, as opposed to the how they changed it in the movie and made a version that, well, people just like. It's just likable.
Well, until we do our
Friday
month,
Night Lights episode,
our month series, which is just going to be called Bergman, we'll put a pin in that discussion.
Oh, yeah, we have. You know what? We you and I have talked about needing to do a month of just Top Gun knockoffs, and Peter Berg stars in a Top Gun knockoff. Aspen Extreme.
I don't know this movie.
It's Top Gun on skis, and Peter Berg is the goose. He's the guy that dies in a skiing accident halfway through that our hero needs to, because it's a Paris skiing competition, and it's it's a thing. It's a thing that exists.
So Flop Gun or Knock Gun? Which one are we going to call it? We'll have to
not gun is probably.
Oh my God! If you are taking a drink in this episode, every time we talk about future episodes, you're dead right now. And my condolences to your family. But we're gonna wrap up this episode before we kill anybody else. So thank you so much for listening. We will be back next week with a. I don't know if you noticed on Facebook, Cargill, but I posted some puzzles. Some clues, if you will, as to what our movies were going to be. For this movie, there's a picture of Jesus' tomb with the stone rolled away, and then right next to it, a close-up of the stone that was rolled away. So you have tomb, stone. Some people figured that out. I was very impressed. And next week was a picture of Don Cheadle from Iron Man 3, or Iron Man 2, I don't remember. And then just a picture of a house. So you have James Rhodes and a house. Roadhouse is, in fact, as many of you guessed, the movie we are going to be covering next week.
Our next Sam Elliott movie.
Our next Sam
Holy
Elliott movie.
Holy shit, Sam Elliott.
Oh,
Sam
man. Elliott back to back Sam Elliott.
Sam Elliott without the stash, but with a glorious mullet.
If you achieve an erection that lasts more than 4 hours because of watching back-to-back Sam Elliott movies, alert your physician immediately, but don't tell us.
It's actually perfectly normal.
It's perfectly normal. In fact, don't call your doctor. Call a press conference. Anyway, we're going to wrap up this episode. If you want to hear more of this, which why wouldn't you? iTunes and Stitcher. You can follow the show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Or, Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me at Twitter, twitter.com, at Massaworm, MassaWyrm. Or on Facebook, facebook.com/Massaworm.
Awesome. And you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. And definitely, if you really like the show, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. The more you guys pledge, the longer we can keep doing this. And we definitely love doing it. So consider doing that. And if you are looking for grade A entertainment and grade F beef that we will probably still eat, we're your huckleberries.